This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
You are listening to the History of Persia podcast. And as we've been hearing from Trevor, the history of the Persian Empire is a story of Persian domination of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. But this was not the first time these lands were conquered, and it would certainly not be the last. I don't want to give too much away, but in the year 329 BCE, the important Persian city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan was conquered by some guy by the name of Alexander. But what's interesting about this city is that about 1700 years later, this same city, Samarkand, would be the glowing capital of an empire forged by a man known as Timur, or Tamerlane, or simply Timur. And Timur has gone down in history as a fantastic tactician, a man who supposedly never lost a battle, a great patron of the arts, and one of the most brutal conquerors of all time. From about 1365 until 1405 CE, Timur was almost constantly at war, building for himself an empire that stretched from modern-day Turkey to India, from Syria to the Russian steppe, and I want to know how and why this happened. If that sounds interesting to you and you want the story of Timur told by a guy who talks too fast and has loud neighbors, then check out my show, The Timur Podcast. Find out more about it at timurpodcast.com or listen to it in most places where you find podcasts. And with that said, take it away, Trevor.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America's Secret Wars, the podcast all about forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately buried times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign soil. I am your host, Trevor Cully, and if there is a miserable echo in my audio, I apologize. I am doing my best with a half-moved-into office. Today, I have Anthony from the Disastrous History Podcast. How are you doing, Anthony?
I am alive.
That is a good starting point. And better than we can say for anybody we're talking about today, because it was 100 plus years ago.
Yeah.
So you do a podcast about historical disasters, as the title suggests.
I cover pretty much anything that goes boom, burns, sinks, gets flooded, blows away. Pretty much anything that is destroyed in some form or fashion is inside my wheelhouse.
Well, today we will be talking about people getting destroyed in my military history adjacent podcast. But the question I like to start people off with here is, what was your relationship to American history in school, middle, high school, college, whatever?
I loved it. I was very, very fond of American history. I took multiple history classes in college once I got there. My high school gave out awards for best history student, and I won it 3 years in a row. So I was very, very much enjoyed American history.
Good. Did you, like, were there particular eras in, you know, the last 250 odd years that, like, got skipped over? Obviously there's stuff that gets focused on, but were there any, like, whole chunks of time that just got left out wholesale.
Oh, yeah. I went to high school in the middle of nowhere. So it was American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, briefly touched on the Civil War, World War II.
Yeah, that sounds about right. My listeners will have heard a little bit of this before, but my high school history curriculum was weird because the AP US history class, you know, has to restart at 1492 and work its way forward like you've done for every American history class since you were like 7. But the non-AP class for that same junior year of high school started in the 1870s. So they got a lot of like Gilded Age stuff and World War I stuff. And we were running out of breath trying to get to the 20th century that same year.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think the first time I talked about World War I in class was until college. And that was specifically because I took a class on that era.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That'll get you. I got lucky and had a world history teacher in high school who had a big interest in the Russian Revolution. So you can't get away with not talking about World War I.
Yeah.
And today is actually the start of a kind of World War I periphery series that I'm doing. Very loosely connected, but the next 3 to 5 episodes are going to be stuff about things that happened during and after the First World War that weren't technically part of it. Though sometimes, especially what we're talking about today, it gets lumped in.
Yeah.
As the American leader, mostly because the Germans sent that one telegram asking Mexico to invade. And that's a large part of why we did World War I, the United States.
Oh, the Zimmerman telegram.
End of this pod.
My random side story, the Zimmerman telegram was the name of a shot my college roommate liked to take that was Jaeger and tequila mixed together, which is as awful as it sounds.
But that's a great name for that.
Yeah. He would walk up to the bar and go, "Can I have a Zimmerman telegram?" And the bartender would be like, "Huh?" And I would have to explain and then explain the background. And they're still like, "I'm not making that."
I have too much respect for my liquor to do that to you. Yeah. The other option would be to do a shot of Jaeger, a shot of gin, and then a shot of tequila. Ah. Oh. Get that British interception in there.
God, that would be awful.
Speaking of times the U.S. almost could have gone to war with Mexico, what do you know about our relationship with our inimitable next-door neighbors to the south?
You know, it's like having a sibling. Sometimes you love them. Sometimes you want to beat them with a shoe.
Yeah, in our history, I think it's been quite a lot more of the beat them with the shoe option. Just... we have invaded Mexico just a shitload of times.
Yes.
The American military has actually been invading Mexico every couple of decades since before Mexico won its independence from Spain. And I'm currently working on an outline for how best to talk about all of that without accidentally becoming a History of Mexico podcast.
I mean, at this point, it kind of seems like we're due for an invasion of Mexico. Been a while.
Yeah, we that is one of the scarier things about some of Donald Trump's rhetoric in this election cycle is that we are historically speaking well overdue for invading Mexico.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Just about since the stuff we're talking about today, save for maybe some, you know, agreed upon policing actions, but those don't really count.
You gotta love the agreed upon invasion.
Yeah, you know, when they're like, "Yeah, please, would you send some Marines down here? Because we can't do this on our own." However, today we are actually talking about an incident where America and Mexico teamed up to fight another nation, specifically the Yaqui people, an indigenous tribe from what is now the Mexican state of Sonora. And more specifically, we are going to talk about the Yaqui Uprising of 1896. Anthony, have you ever even heard of these people or this event?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I hadn't either until I was several links off from the starting point on congressionally approved list of all the times that the U.S. has invaded other countries.
Congressionally approved.
The foundational source for this whole show is a congressional report from 2004, wonder why, of all the times the U.S. deployed military force without declaring war.
That's a convenient year for it to be written.
Can't imagine why.
Wonder what happened.
Why the
I
government
wonder what happened then.
largest protest movement in 50 years, notwithstanding.
Definitely didn't invade anybody around then.
At just 2 to 12 places that were definitely not still in. back to one of our earlier forever wars. This is going to be a weird one because we are basically telling the story of a couple of small raids that spilled over the U.S.-Mexican border. And it isn't going to be a lot of blow-by-blow descriptions of battles or campaign strategy because, frankly, it was too damn small on the American side for stuff like that to be documented.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Instead, we are going to talk a lot about the people behind the events and a lot about the context that is indigenous and Mexican history instead of U.S.-American history.
I do love Mexican history. It's so fascinating.
Well, we start with the Yaqui, or the Hiyaki people, who have never been a huge community. They originated primarily along a stretch of the Yaqui River in modern Sonora near the Pacific coast. In a cluster of about 80 towns and villages when they first encountered Europeans. And since they were in modern Mexico, that put the Yaqui right on the cutting bloody edge of European colonialism when the Spanish first started expanding into North America. To give you a sense of how this story pans out in advance, at first contact in the 1530s, the Spanish estimated that there were about 30,000 Yaqui. So probably a little bit higher than that, but not by that much. They had the sense of the general region, but they couldn't actually go in and see everybody.
Was that before or after the original murders by the Spanish?
That is before.
Oh.
So never a huge population at all. Today, 500 years later, there are about 39,000 Yaqui. That population typically moves on an exponential curve, and that is not it.
No, shockingly higher than I expected, but not good.
Yeah. 9,000 additional people in 500 years is a staggeringly horrifying decline. Because that means you went way down from that original 30,000 number.
Yeah. I was expecting you to just stop at 39.
There are 39 people left. Population decline is going to be... And when I say decline, I do mean genocide, in case anybody's wondering here. It is a 100%. Genocide episode. Possibly our first genocide episode, now that I think about it.
Ooh, thank you for inviting
me. Which makes me feel like a dick, because there's at least two genocides in the next, four episodes.
I'm honored to be the first.
Yeah, congratulations, Anthony. As far as both the Spaniards and modern archaeology could tell, the Yaqui had only recently transitioned from hunter-gatherer to agricultural lifestyle when the Spanish arrived. So they weren't in an incredibly stable position to begin with. And a lot of my sources for this episode say that the land was owned communally, but that's not quite right. The land simply wasn't owned at all, beyond the general idea of not wanting other people to invade and kick the Yaqui out.
That makes sense. More of a family type existed here rather than a individual ownership.
Yeah. Produce could be owned by the family that worked a given tract of land. Homes built on it belonged to their residents. Objects belonged to the people who used them, etc. But the land was just land. There's not even much evidence for exploitation of labor or class divide. There was very little hierarchy, and what existed was based more on age and gender. The Yaqui didn't produce surplus crops for trade, but they did occasionally trade salt and fish for luxury items from further inland. A lot of Aztec turquoise being imported in exchange for salt was a staple of their economy, such as it was. In times of war, their communal elders and veterans formed a council, and the veterans took command of their village's fighting men. But this didn't translate to any sort of official status in peacetime. Sadly, we don't know a whole lot about the early Yaqui religion. The Spanish commented that they lacked temples or idols that they could identify and noticed specific dances and festivals, but they didn't care about the context in the 1500s.
Shocking.
The Mexican scholar Miguel Othon de Mendizabal observed the absence of collective cult of an organized and hierarchical priesthood consequently led each individual to be the priest of his own cult, the interpreter of his own religion. So that is the kind of cultural starting point when the Spanish arrive.
Makes sense. Kind of tracks with most, I think, native cultures, especially along that area of the country.
Yeah, this area of northern Mexico was not particularly settled at the time of European contact. It's not particularly settled today, frankly.
Because they say it's not exactly settled now. It's not great country.
No, it is. This is a thin strip of riverland in what is mostly desert.
I was going to say, that's basically the location of Hotel California.
Yeah. This area is a lot like what Los Angeles was before they turned the Los Angeles River into an empty concrete basin. So, like, that's what they're working with.
That is one of the most disappointing things I've ever seen. When I went to Los Angeles and saw that basin, I was just like,
it's the LA River where, you know, you can drive motorcycles. So that's the situation. And the Spanish show up fresh off their conquest of the Aztec Empire in south central Mexico. They had heard rumors of fabulous cities of gold and mythical kingdoms ruled by Amazonian warrior women. These did not exist for them to actually find, but the early Spanish expeditions into the region were also essentially massive slave raids. They were kidnapping and forcing indigenous people into bondage all across northern Mexico. And they reached the Yaqui and their neighbors, the Mayo, in 1533. Rumors of strange white assholes killing and murdering their way across the land preceded the army by several years, and one Spanish soldier on the expedition reported that upon reaching Yaqui territory, the local warriors marched out and drew a line in the dirt, declaring that they would kill any Spaniard who crossed it.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, which seems quite reasonable, honestly.
It does. And it also is not shocking that the Spanish went looking for cities of gold and then decided to murder everyone that didn't have a city of gold.
Well, right. If they had found a city of gold, what do you think would have happened?
They would have murdered them too, but also
they would have emptied that city and then melted it down.
That was their specialty, was melting down gold and murdering. Murdering was also one.
It's hard to be a god, or however the song goes. The invaders in this case fired a cannon directly at the assembled Yaqui warriors, who attacked the Spanish in return.
That's a dick move.
Which is something they had never seen before this battle. Usually, their initial use of giant, thunderous, mass-killing machines scared people off, and the Yaqui kind of turned the Spanish strategy on their head.
I mean, it's pretty impressive when you get shot at by giant murder cannon, and then you're like, you know what? Fuck you. And the horse you rode in on.
And fuck you, and I'm gonna stab you to death with an obsidian knife.
Well, and I mean, I guess it was probably a decent gamble that they fired it once. They probably don't have the ability to load it and fire it again before I get there and stab them to death.
Yeah, you just kind of hedge your bets with, you know, whatever rumors you've heard about guns up to this point and go for it. And that actually worked in this case, because it was a pretty small Spanish expedition, all things considered. They were pretty far out from the main hub of the old Aztec Empire. And the Spaniards in this case were wildly outnumbered. So they were actually forced to retreat and negotiated a peace deal with the Yaqui that lasted for the next 30 years. The Yaqui scared the Spanish in the first couple of decades of colonization.
That's fair. I would also be scared.
Yeah. Yeah. You shoot a cannon through the middle of an army and they charge.
like that dude just got turned into a pink mist and now his friends are running at me. I'm going to go that way.
Yeah. I'm just right away. There's a lot of other Mexico to conquer. You can leave this one river alone for a while.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. It took until the 1560s before the Spanish even started really interacting with the general area of the Yaqui River. And they still didn't go into Yaqui lands militarily. But they did begin conquering and enslaving most of the Yaqui's neighbors. And just because they weren't going in militarily doesn't mean Spaniards weren't entering the Yaqui River Basin at all. They just went in religiously.
Of course they did.
Catholic missionaries flooded into all corners of the new colonial empire. And you get this weird kind of dual stance where there are tons of Jesuit missionaries preaching to the Yaqui who simultaneously maintain constant military readiness. They transform over the second half of the 16th century into a militant society, always ready to counter a Spanish invasion when it finally comes. Despite the fact that slowly but surely, they're Catholicizing en masse.
So they were the Spartans of Mexico?
Yeah, a little bit.
Maybe a little bit better at, you know, fighting.
Yeah, you know, not having the weird property class system that hamstrings Sparta all the time probably
maybe not
help them out quite a lot. Yeah, that too. Lack of mountains in the area.
Yeah. We're not ruling the mountain throwing out, just saying that they didn't have them there to make it so that they could do it.
Exactly. For the most part, this whole process remained peaceful into the 1700s, despite constant military preparedness and mass conversion to Catholicism. In part because when the Jesuits fell out of favor briefly with the Catholic Church, they could continue to operate in Yaqui territory and some of the neighboring areas unimpeded as kind of a safe haven among the indigenous people away from the Spanish government.
Makes sense.
And that only further reinforced the Catholicism in the community. High rates of conversion kept Spanish slavers out, but once gold mines were discovered on Yaqui land, Spanish settlers poured in and the Yaqui allied with their Mayo neighbors to resist. This led to some territorial loss after fighting the Spanish for the first time in almost 200 years, but the Yaqui did remain largely independent. Then...
I was going to say the gold is the siren call of the Spanish.
Yeah, it really is. You don't see the impact immediately after they start colonizing, but by about 1700, the world gold supply had been so thoroughly thrown off by Spanish colonization that most of the powers of Europe had to completely reconfigure their economies to accommodate all of the gold and silver that the Spanish were mining in Mexico.
Yeah, it's a lot of gold.
Like it was literal mountains of precious metal.
And they even lost a lot of it in the Caribbean because, you know, hurricanes.
Tons of it is still at the bottom of the ocean, and I learned this recently. It is legally still the property of the Spanish crown.
Huh.
So when a Spanish shipwreck is found, like, off the coast of Florida, they can't legally raise it because it belongs to Spain. But Spain doesn't really have the money or the interest to do anything about it.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think there's one off the coast of Florida that was found in, like, the 70s or 80s. And they brought up some of it, and they got into a lawsuit with the state of Florida about it.
Yeah, it's who owns shipwrecks is its own weird, complicated thing.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, on the other side of Mexico, and in this case, in the rest of Mexico, in 1821, Mexico threw out the Spanish and declared independence. Strapped for cash as a new state, Mexico tried to tax the Yaqui, a shift from Spanish policy of leave those guys alone. So long as they don't fight us, we won't fight them. The Yaqui fought back
against
Mexican taxation, and for most of the following century, that was the pattern. Mexico, under the various governments that came and went, tried to subject the Yaqui to rule by the Mexican state. The Yaqui fought back, lost some ground, suffered massive casualties, but remained largely independent.
That tracks. Always is the taxes.
Two certainties in life.
Death and taxes.
And the Yaqui, for the Yaqui, they were mostly the same certainty.
Sounds like it was mostly just death.
Yeah, death because taxes. This became nearly constant, with Mexico seizing and selling off Yaqui land and Yaqui guerrillas fighting back in the hills. Yaqui captured in this process were routinely sold into slavery and worked to death in the mines that had replaced their ancestral villages, or sent to sugar plantations in Oaxaca. This escalated dramatically under the rule of the Mexican dictator Porfirio Diaz, who repeatedly imposed new taxes, new restrictions, and land confiscations on the Yaqui, specifically to provoke rebellions that could be used as an excuse to seize land and sell more enslaved indigenous people.
You know, every time I read about Porfirio Diaz, I realize just how much of an asshole that guy was.
He's a monster.
Just like, a huge ass all the time.
It takes a special kind of late 19th, early 20th century dictator to plunge your country into a decades-long civil war, and somehow there were two of them.
On purpose.
Yeah. Like, engineered. Like
he does it on purpose. Like, I feel like he's one of those people that gets overlooked as one of the biggest assholes of all time. But he's a dark horse contender.
Yeah, Porfirio Diaz did so much that we just don't have time to fully cover today. So I'll recommend Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast for his series on the Mexican Revolution. Suffice to say, Diaz was a political and military leader who was elected president in 1876, stepped down briefly to let his chosen candidate take the presidency briefly while he focused on building Mexico into a dictatorship. And then he came back to the presidency, abolished term limits and judicial independence, then ruled for decades in a government historians call the Porfiriato.
Yep. And Duncan's episodes about it are great. Just throwing that out there.
Yes, everybody go listen to the Revolutions podcast as soon as you're done with this and come back to this in a year when you finish half of it. In a year, you might be caught up to the Russian Revolution, and in like three, you might finish.
Yeah.
Unlike Mike Duncan, I do not have almost 20 years of listenership to fall back on and need to place a couple extra ads. So one of them is going to go right here.
You are listening to the History of Persia podcast. And as we've been hearing from Trevor, the history of the Persian Empire is a story of Persian domination of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. But this was not the first time these lands were conquered, and it would certainly not be the last. I don't want to give too much away, but in the year 329 BCE, the important Persian city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan was conquered by some guy by the name of Alexander. But what's interesting about this city is that about 1700 years later, this same city, Samarkand, would be the glowing capital of an empire forged by a man known as Timur, or Tamerlane, or simply Timur. And Timur has gone down in history as a fantastic tactician, a man who supposedly never lost a battle, a great patron of the arts, and one of the most brutal conquerors of all time. From about 1365 until 1405 CE, Timur was almost constantly at war, building for himself an empire that stretched from modern-day Turkey to India, from Syria to the Russian steppe, and I want to know how and why this happened. If that sounds interesting to you and you want the story of Timur told by a guy who talks too fast and has loud neighbors, then check out my show, The Timur Podcast. Find out more about it at timurpodcast.com or listen to it in most places where you find podcasts. And with that said, take it away, Trevor.
Back to Porfirio Diaz.
Asshole.
Yeah. Oh, God. To secure power, Diaz massively expanded his military, modernized it, and installed cronies as officers. He granted more power and influence to the Catholic Church than it had enjoyed in Mexico, basically since independence. And most importantly for us, though he was a big fan of industrialization and he hated indigenous people, he is up there with Andrew Jackson in the annals of people who just really hated the native inhabitants of this continent.
Yeah.
Industrialization under the Porfiriato meant selling off land and resources to American companies, exporting huge amounts of agricultural produce from massive foreign-owned farms, and seizing land from small peasants and indigenous families to exploit it. Resistance, especially indigenous resistance, was punished with death or slavery.
Good God.
Slavery as, it's like the Roman Empire to a degree of like he is starting fights so that he can sell people into slavery.
Yeah.
Like it is a genuinely like ancient brutal mindset, but for factory farming.
The worst possible, like somehow it's just worse.
It's like if you let Julius Caesar run Monsanto. It's insane.
Yes. God. That dude was the worst. I can't fathom being like, you know what? You know who needs to have more power? The people that make tacos.
What if the government made or owned all the corn and sold those farms to American corporations?
What's the name of that? I was trying to think of the company. Not Monsanto. There's another one. Chiquita.
Ah, yes. The banana people.
The banana company. Not tacos. Banana.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry. This podcast will be hearing from Chiquita Bananas very soon.
I was like, it's not tacos. Tacos is not the one I wanted. I wanted banana. I don't know how I got I had tacos for dinner. That would be
and
why.
You had tacos for dinner and we're talking about Mexico.
I wanted the he was preparing Central America for Chiquita.
Yeah, the Chiquita Banana Company gets a whole category of wars named after it. But for a little further north, the last major conflict with hundreds of men on battlefields between the Mexican army and the Yaqui was in the 1860s. But due in part to the Porfiriato's aggressive land seizures and anti-indigenous attitude, a Taliban-esque, Taliban-Viet Cong, just constant low-grade guerrilla war had been going on for almost 30 years by 1896.
That's a long time to be fighting a war.
Yes, it is.
That's a lot of bringing your children up in the war, and just that sounds terrible.
That is three or four generations of Yaqui raised to fight the Mexican government.
Yeah.
As like, that is what your father did, that is what you will do, that is what your children will do.
And then post that, it's going to be hard to stop.
And that is part of the issue that comes up today. There are actually two other indigenous groups directly involved in this brewing conflict that I couldn't find quite as much information about. The first is the Acamel Owadom or Pima people, whose traditional home was along the Gila River, straddling the modern U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona. They had extremely little contact with the colonizers around them until the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, which led to the U.S. claiming their territory. Officially, it was declared a reservation, and even then, it took several decades before the U.S. exerted any kind of political influence over the Acamel Owadom.
That sounds like the U.S.
Yeah, they were like, well, there are native people there, so it's a reservation now, because we're not going to do anything.
We just want it.
Like, it is behind this line that we drew with the Mexican government, but it's also mostly a desert, so... Okay, you can do that for now until we find something to use it for.
Till we find oil.
Yeah.
And then you'll have freedom.
I think in this case they probably found uranium or rare earth elements.
Probably. We'll find something to bring them freedom.
Yeah. I know that uranium mining is a problem on the Navajo reservation in the same area. Just permanently poisoned their water supply in the 50s.
Of course we did. We're really good at that one.
Permanently poisoning water supplies, we are the best at it.
Really good at that one. We even do that to ourselves.
Yeah, we don't have clean water supplies anymore, to be quite honest. That is a relic of a previous century. For about 30 years, the Acamel Owadom mostly benefited as their villages became hubs of trade and rest stops for Americans on their way to California. But the 1870s saw the arrival of the Bureau of Indian Affairs as American colonists settled on stolen Owadom land. As the territory shrank to inhospitable desert alone, their agriculture collapsed, residential schools were established to effectively kidnap and re-educate Owadom children, and their community was barely surviving on federal rations and woodworking crafts, basically. They became kind of one of the very early examples of that stereotype of the rest stop gift store in the American Southwest.
Yes. Yeah. I was going to say on the way to California means they were stopping in there on the way to California to die of dysentery.
Yeah, basically. It was the route you could take in the winter when the Donner Pass was out of reservations. The third group, it's a very desirable menu.
It is. You don't want to take your family there. Maybe some friends.
The third group in this conflict were the Mayo, or the Yoreme, who lived right next to the Yaqui. There's a bit less information about them before colonization because they had more contact and direct conflict with the Spanish, which means a lot of their pre-invasion traditions were not as well documented before being wiped out. Like the Yaqui, most of the Mayo converted to Catholicism as a defensive tactic, but they were not as militarily formidable. Early on, all three of these groups had actually formed a confederacy with the Apache to fight the Spaniards, but various colonial wars and internecine fighting had fractured that by the 19th century. For this episode, the Acamel Awadam are primarily involved because some of their resistance fighters are going to throw in with the Yaqui during their last big rebellion. But although the Mayo routinely joined their neighbors' resistance to Mexican colonization, they didn't directly join this fight. One particularly influential Mayo woman did, and her name was Teresa Urrea, the Saint of Cabora.
It's a good name.
Yeah. Teresa's story starts in a dark place.
Fantastic.
And I'm just going to read the early life section from her Wikipedia article because it is incredibly fucked up.
Oh, good. How can we get more dark than genocide?
Urrea was born in 1873 in Ocaroni, Sinaloa. Her father, Tomas Urrea, was from Alamos, Sonora, and owned a rancho in Cabora, to the northeast of Alamos. Her mother, Cayetana Chavez, was an indigenous 14-year-old ranch hand from Tehueco. Throughout her early life, which was spent in Cabora and nearby Aquilacuichi, her father largely ignored her, and she was raised by her bitter aunt and quiet mother.
Her mom was 14 when she was born?
Her mom was 14. A 14-year-old indigenous ranch hand is how Wikipedia describes this relationship.
That's generous. Feels like a generous read for
Maybe a little surprisingly, the Texas State Historical Association does at least a little better identifying Teresa as an illegitimate daughter of Tomas Urrea, a well-to-do rancher and political liberal who moved his household to a small homestead in southern Sonora to escape the political reprisals from the Porfiriato.
Yeah, that seems more accurate.
What neither of them say, but I will, is that Tomas Urrea raped a 14-year-old child employee and provided as little as he could get away with to the child that came from that abuse.
Yeah, that seems much more accurate.
In true Mexican style, this girl's birth name was Nina Garcia Nona Maria Rebecca Chavez. And notice that she started out with her mother's last name and not her father's. The Mexican historian Silvia Arom notes that this wasn't at all uncommon for the time and place, and that domestic service on these Western ranchos was effectively a form of enslavement.
Yeah, that indentured servitude borderline.
Yeah. But Tomas did send Nina to school and let her learn how to read until the age of 9 before work on the ranch. So that's good.
This is going to get really bad. I can feel it coming. Oh,
you might be surprised. The situation didn't last that long. And when Nina was 12, Tomas finally decided to recognize her legally as his child and changed her name to Teresa Urrea in the process. She was suddenly thrust into the lifestyle of a minor socialite in her politically active father's household, and one of her primary jobs was assisting her father's new 15-year-old wife, Gabriela.
This man has a type, and it's disturbing.
And that type is awful. Early teens.
God.
That type is children. Yeah.
Why? Why?
Yeah. The book Latina Legacies characterizes this relationship as more like sisters than mother and daughter.
I would say so.
And no shit. They were 3 years apart and literally kids.
I was going to say, there's going to be about really close in age. That seems accurate.
Where Teresa had been raised as an all-but-enslaved peasant on the fringes of the ranch. Gabriella was the daughter of a neighboring ranchero, and she was supposed to help teach Teresa how to be a proper upper-middle-class lady in Mexican society. Teresa did learn the rules, but she didn't like them. She preferred riding horses and tearing around the countryside with her father's vaqueros, aka cowboys, and hanging out with Huila, an indigenous woman employed on the estate to practice traditional medicine and act as a midwife. Teresa became Huila's effective apprentice in her teenage years, but when Teresa turned 16, she fell into a debilitating illness. Presumably with Huila's help, she emerged 3 months later, hearing voices, having visions, and fell into a 2-week-long trance.
Peyote?
Possibly. The symptoms described of her initial illness at least have elements of epilepsy.
Yeah.
But it's not at all clear what exactly was happening here.
The hearing voices.
Yeah. Hearing voices, having visions.
Interesting.
Maybe just a psychotic break. Like, who knows? It's not exactly like she had a stable, healthy upbringing.
No kidding.
Her father was convinced that Teresa was about to die, which makes sense, and made plans for a funeral. But Teresa woke up while they were preparing her body for burial.
You put the cart before the horse there, man. This is the Monty Python
skit. Imagine, yeah, but I'm not dead.
You'll be in a moment.
Yeah. Intermittent seizures and catatonia lasted for a few more months, and Teresa became increasingly introverted and frequently spoke in gibberish. But when things settled, she was convinced that she had received a vision from the Virgin Mary calling on Teresa to heal humanity. She also predicted that somebody on the estate was about to die. Her father openly mocked her at parties for this, but her prediction came true in the saddest possible way. Huila, the healer woman, died shortly after her apprentice regained consciousness.
It's never the asshole dad.
No, it's never the asshole dad. Asshole dad is going to be with us to the end of this story.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
So Teresa's father might have been a skeptic, but her patients, as Huila's replacement, were not. And even by the time she had stopped suffering from regular seizures, Teresa Urrea was already gaining a national reputation as a miracle worker, and Mexican peasants in the surrounding region started venerating her as a living saint. This all happened in just a couple of months during the winter of 1890, and over the next year, she started preaching and interacting with other radical rural preachers in Sonora, including one Yoreme Mayo preacher named Tomohic, whose father had been a general in the last major indigenous revolt in Sonora. Just want everyone to take Tomohic's name and file that one away for a little bit later in the episode.
Foreshadowing.
He'll come back up. In fact, a lot of Teresa's adherents came from indigenous communities in the area, and when she tried to advise a village of how to handle a drought that hit the region, that village and a few of the others where Teresa was active rebelled against the Porfiriato government. Teresa actually fled the region when tensions started turning toward violence, but since her father politically opposed the government and she was both Mayo herself and had ties to indigenous resistance leaders. She was blamed and sentenced to exile.
Oh, seems nicer than it usually is.
Yeah, I think it was a case of, like, we don't want to make a martyr out of them.
Yeah.
Like, when she hit a point where she and her father were famous enough that they couldn't just be shot.
Yeah.
But it didn't pan out that way.
Of course it didn't. Why would it?
Rather than quelling the revolt, Teresa Urrea's name became a rallying cry in rebellious villages all over Sonora. And when the Urrea family reached Nogales on the American border, they were given hero's welcomes before crossing into the United States. They made a martyr out of her anyway.
Yeah, generally happens. You can't let someone with that much power continue to live and not expect it to come back to bite you.
Yeah. Well, that is going to be a weird thing here, is it's not clear whether or not Teresa had that much power, or just the symbol of Teresa had that power. I, for my part, think she was probably more active than she ever let on, yeah. But it's not publicly known.
She probably was a little bit more in there than anyone would let you believe.
Yeah, and that was probably covered up a little bit on purpose. Yeah,
absolutely.
To keep her out of the bullseye, the target of the Porfiriato, so to speak. Once crossing into the U.S., Teresa and Tomas kind of disappear from the historical record for a few years, while tensions back in Mexico continue to escalate between the Porfiriato and a loose alliance of liberal reformers, militant revolutionaries, and indigenous rebels, including many small bands of partisan bandits who took to calling themselves the Teresitas, or the Little Teresas.
That's a good name.
The drought in Sonora was just one of many revolutionary sparks that started smoldering in the early 1890s. There were rebel guerrillas and militias taking up arms against Porfirio Diaz all over the country, but resistance was heavily concentrated and most violent along the U.S.-Mexican border, with enough men and organization to start taking control of individual towns and villages, because they kept deporting political troublemakers to the southern United States.
It's a terrible idea.
So they were all concentrated in the same areas, with no Mexican government oversight, free to stockpile weapons and produce propaganda to their heart's content.
Like, why would you send your biggest enemies to the same spot in a country that doesn't give a shit?
Yeah, it became a problem for the Porfiriato in the end. Mexican central authority had always been looser in the north. See also the existence of Texas.
Unfortunately.
But the Urrea... Yeah, the Urrea family were hardly the first people to flee into exile, and smuggling had been going on both sides of the border for decades. The surge in violence in 1893 finally got the Porfiriato to put enough pressure on the American government to do something about this, and the Mexican argument was pretty simple here. If the U.S. didn't do something about all the arms trafficking, Mexican federales would have to invade the United States.
It's a bold claim.
They were like, if you can't stop all of the illegal border crossings, we're going to have to do it. And people keep bringing your guns into our country.
Who would have been president at that time?
1893?
Was that Zachary Taylor?
No, he's the first Mexican-American War.
Oh, yeah. Trying to think of which president would be like.
It was Cleveland's second term. Ah,
that makes more sense.
Yeah, so Grover Cleveland, round two.
Round two. I feel like some of those presidents around there would have told Mexico to go fuck themselves.
So far, the first and only person to have non-consecutive terms of that office.
Hopefully he remains that way.
Would. Yeah. If you lose, maybe there's a reason for it. I refer everybody back to episode 5 for my official stance on this issue. So the Cleveland administration started targeting Mexican dissidents along the border with surveillance. Victor Ochoa, Laura Aguirre, and Flores Chapa were all officially anti-Porfiriato journalists based out of El Paso, Texas. But Ochoa and Aguirre were detained by El Paso police and accused of violating the Neutrality Act, originally signed into law to stop Americans from attacking the British during the French Revolution. The Neutrality Act prohibits anybody within the U.S. legal jurisdiction from carrying out an act of war against another nation without the U.S. government's say-so, which seems like a good policy for a government to have if you're going to have a government.
It does.
It hasn't particularly stopped people.
I mean, the U.S. has welcomed several political dissidents of many countries that are openly planning things for other countries. The French Revolution's a big one.
They had their say-so, right? there, at some point, I will be doing an episode on Silvercorp and the attempted overthrow of the Venezuelan government with airsoft rifles, but... That is a story for a different day. So they were accused of violating the Neutrality Act, but there wasn't enough evidence to convict either of them at this time. Immediately after being released, Victor Ochoa crossed the border to command a guerrilla force of 120 men in an attack against the Mexican Federales.
Yeah, that tracks. It's also what I would do.
He lost that battle, came back to Texas, and started raising another militia within American territory to invade Mexico.
I love him.
He and his men were arrested by the Texas Rangers in 1894, and Ochoa couldn't get out of that one. Which, you know, fair. Sure. Like, you shot your shot and you missed.
I mean, it sounds like the Rangers have been disappointing people for a long time, and not just in baseball.
Yeah. So... Ochoa was arrested by Chuck Norris and friends, and then Aguirre was put under surveillance. So a few months later, or about a year later, the Urreas resurface in late 1895, living in Solomonville, Arizona, a small farming community at the time, which became a hub of Mexican revolutionaries in exile, alongside a few members of Tomas Urrea's household, who appear on various records from the town, apparently having fled persecution with their boss. This is where things get a bit weird. The Urreas, as if none of this has been weird already, I know. The Urreas fell in with the local exile community, especially Laura Aguirre and Flores Chapa. These two published a plan for revolution in their illegal underground newspaper, including a declaration of support signed by 23 Mexican exiles, including one of the Urrea's staff, and someone named Loreto Escaveria, which was Tomas's first wife's name.
That's confusing.
So either this is a relative, or according to some speculation, it's just Tomas using a pseudonym.
It's probably that one. Yeah.
Which makes a lot more sense.
It's weird he used his first wife's name.
First name he thought of, I guess. Yeah, who knows?
That's weird. Anyway.
So Laura Aguirre and Flores Chapa were arrested by American authorities at the request of the Mexican consulate after publishing plans to overthrow the Mexican government in a newspaper. Which again, like, fuck the Porfiriato. But also, yeah, that makes sense. That's what happens.
Pretty common cause and effect there.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing, though. And the trial focused heavily on their friend Teresa's supposed revolutionary activity, but nothing could be definitively proven in court. So they all moved to El Paso, Texas together with their families. Publicly, Teresa continued to deny any militant involvement, and it is totally possible that her name and reputation were co-opted by her dad and his friends for political gain. But they certainly put a lot of revolutionary words in her mouth when they wrote about her in the illegal paper, and she was an adult by now, totally capable of escaping their orbit if she really wanted to.
Yeah, she probably could have said something as well.
Yeah, if she had gone to any other journalist in El Paso, they probably would have written a story about her, and instead, a lot of the local El Paso press is covering for her at this time, very obviously.
Yeah.
Teresa went back to work as a healer and a preacher, and accounts vary wildly as to whether her preaching was radically anti-Porfiriato or sweet apolitical preaching, depending on who is writing. Latina Legacies suggests that friends in the El Paso press played up her apolitical side to keep unwanted attention away, but by then her name was already tied to the call to arms that her friends had published before leaving Arizona, and lots of local press who didn't know Teresa personally were saying that she was a political radical. El Paso's not a huge place at the time, so they could have gone to check.
Yeah, kind of seems like she was playing both sides to keep herself centered.
Yeah.
She was pulling it in with the healing and the apoliticalness, and then bam, revolutionary.
Yeah, she was playing a lot of plausible deniability is the sense that I get from a lot of these accounts. Like I've said before, I believe it is entirely possible that Teresa didn't think of her own rhetoric as political. She was raised in an impoverished Mayo peasant home and came of age around her father's political, liberal, pro-democracy friends. The Porfiriato stripped people of like her of their land and their rights and left them to be functionally medieval serfs. The morals of everyone around Teresa were anti-Porfirio Diaz. So even if she was just preaching what she saw as morally correct, those morals were revolutionary. So whether Teresa planned a revolt herself, or more likely just inspired it with her pro-indigenous, anti-Porfiriato preaching, her friend's call to arms, and the association with Santa Teresa, 70 Yaqui and Acamelawada men who had crossed into the United States to work on the Southern Pacific Railroad took up arms. They picked up their rifles, grabbed their horses, and crossed the border into the Mexican side of Nogales, where they raided a customs house where all the tariff and tax payments for American goods were stored. They seized the money and emptied the town's federal arsenal in the name of the Saint of Cabora early in the morning of August 12th, 1896.
It's always the customs house and always the armory.
If you're going to steal from places as a revolutionary, those are the places to steal from.
Yeah, or, it's always the best.
Yeah, you know, guns and money. What more does a political radical need?
More people, usually.
Warren Zevon would say lawyers is the third thing to add to that list, I guess.
Yeah. Lawyers, more people.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Occasionally drugs and alcohol.
No, that goes without saying. It's 1896. The laudanum is flowing freely. Let's see. Let's call it and say the listeners can raid some products, services, and probably just a bunch of podcast ads.
Gamarjoba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sacartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Cartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sacartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sacartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled SAQARTVELO. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
And we are back, and a group of Yaqui militant revolutionaries have just raided the Mexican customs house in Nogales, Sonora. The Sonoran State Police and Arizona Militia joined forces to assault the Yaqui raiders held up inside the customs house, while local governments on both sides of the border scrambled to call for help because they weren't sure which side of the border the Terracitas were going to flee toward. As the raiders fled Nogales, carrying as much money and armament as their horses could bear, they left behind at least 3 dead and more wounded, both from their own side and from the defending town militia.
You never shoot your own people when you're a revolutionary. Well, you eventually do, but you can't do it during battle.
Well, it's not clear in any of the documentation I could find who was actually dead in this situation. All of it just kind of lumps all the casualties together and doesn't specify who was getting shot.
That makes sense. Some of those, it might be a little bit difficult to tell which side they were actually on.
Yeah, it's not like, I mean, it's a bunch of local militia and a bunch of local bandits. It's not like anybody's wearing uniforms.
Yeah.
Afterwards, the federales show up and they're like, well, yep, there's a bunch of dead Mexican people. Probably.
Yeah, that guy's dead.
That guy might be from Arizona. Who knows?
Who knows? And it was very, the fluid, sounds like the border was relatively fluid at this point. So it could be.
Yeah, this is well before even the concept of a border patrol was really in place. The Texas Rangers provided most of America's border security at this point.
Which was negligible.
And given that this is set in Arizona, that means very little. On the Mexican side, the police passed on their call for help to the federal army. The Americans sent a telepath. Ha, that would be much faster and more terrifying.
It would.
Sent a telegraph directly to Fort Huacua. Huacua.
I'm proud of you for even trying.
Yeah. Huacua. Listeners, somebody email me how you think that is supposed to be pronounced. And this went to Brigadier General Frank Whedon, who promptly dispatched 2 companies of the U.S. 24th Infantry. It doesn't play a huge role in this story, but it's worth noting that the 24th was one of the Buffalo Soldier regiments.
I was going to say, it sounds really familiar.
Yeah, I think they may be the original. I can't remember. They're one of the very first, at least, of the permanent standing all-black U.S. Army regiments routinely deployed in the western U.S. during the 19th century. They supposedly got their bison-themed nickname from a comparison that indigenous people made between black people's hair and buffalo fur. It comes off as more than a little racist today, but so far as I can tell, it was more a comment on the novelty than anything else. Especially further north, there just weren't that many black people in Western North America in the 1870s. And the Buffalo Soldier moniker was generally taken as a source of pride until pretty recently, when people started painting out or pointing out that it was basically taking pride in participation in genocide.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, there's a lot to be said for racial discrimination in the U.S. military's history. There's also a lot to be said for, no matter what your role was in the U.S. Army in the 1890s, you were involved in some pretty heinous shit.
And this is a thing that I learned recently about specifically the 1890s, is they gave out Medal of Honors like candy for fighting in the wars out west.
Oh, yeah. In the episode of this podcast that came out just before this one, Will, we talked about the time we invaded Korea in the 1870s. A a reprisal for a group of preachers and missionaries and adventurers entering Korea against its own government's wishes and promptly trying to fight the Korean army on their own. And
that sounds American.
The expedition that came after that resulted in the first medals of honor for overseas combat.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah. Some weird stories come out of that one.
Huh.
No medals of honor today, unfortunately, for the fighting men of the 24th. But those Buffalo soldiers participated in one of America's favorite military pastimes in 1896, propping up a dictatorship in Latin America because 200 men of the 24th were sent to link up with the Sonoran police.
Hell yeah. We do love propping up a dictatorship here in America.
Oh yeah, the further south in our own hemisphere, the better.
Hey, nobody else can invade us, but we can invade them.
Yeah, well, if you got to get through, you know, Mexico or Canada first, because if you're not coming over land, we've got 4 out of the 5 biggest air forces on the planet. Like each branch of our military has its own air force,
which just seems like overkill.
I believe that is the definition of an air force. So the 24th Infantry intercepted the Yaqui Terracitas back on the U.S. side of the border, where at least one contemporary report says the raiding party had reinforcements waiting. A gunfight ensued, killing the Mexican police captain leading the chase, which threw off the pursuit long enough for the Terracitas to escape into the southern Arizona wilderness and quietly disperse back to their respective homes and railway camps, while the Buffalo soldiers and the Mexican army patrolled on their sides of the border. All told, the skirmishing left 14 dead, split evenly between the Mexican cops and the Terracitas themselves. Loro Aguirre continued publishing his partisan newspaper and totally not smuggling weapons to Mexican rebels from El Paso until 1902, at which point he was arrested again, exonerated again, but still ordered to shut down his newspaper.
God, how many times are they going to arrest this guy?
I think this is the last time for him. He did write a letter to President Theodore Roosevelt alleging that the Porfiriato was sending agents to kidnap him. A U.S. federal investigation found no evidence of a kidnapping plot, but that doesn't mean a whole lot in 1902.
I mean, if you're going to get a president that is going to do something about it, Teddy Roosevelt's the one.
Yeah, you know, he really, you just caught him at the wrong moment, because if you'd been like, I live in the U.S. and Mexico wants to kidnap me, there is a like 40% chance Teddy Roosevelt would have invaded Mexico.
Based on that statement, yeah. Just straight up, they're going to kidnap me, invade Mexico.
Really, he should have sent a ship into the Gulf and blown it up. That would have, that historically, that is a great way of convincing Teddy Roosevelt to do wars.
I mean, historically, it's a great way of convincing America to do anything.
That is true. If you want to marry, except stop supporting Israel.
Correct. Yes.
The one time somebody blew up an American ship and we didn't promptly respond with military action is the time that Israel did it to the USS Liberty. A fun future episode that I have planned.
Oh God, you have fun with that.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna turn off all forms of social media for like a month. So Loro promptly started publishing a new newspaper and officially joined the Mexican Liberty or Liberal Party, or the PLM, which was, despite its name, one of the most militant and extreme anti-Porfirio organizations in Mexico prior to the revolution.
I feel like starting a newspaper was the 18th and 19th century version of starting a new Twitter account.
Yes, absolutely. Newspapers and political zines were just 19th century Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, down to the beefing with somebody who should have no significance to you whatsoever in the comments. Like,
correct.
The culture is disturbingly similar.
You get one newspaper shut down, that's fine. I'll just go buy a new printing press and start a new one.
Exactly. Loro became president of the El Paso branch of the PLM and led an insurrection when the party tried to cross the border and seize control of Ciudad Juarez. This failed, but since there was no actual evidence that any of it had been organized on U.S. soil, when the Porfiriato tried to have Lauro Aguirre extradited, they had to use falsified murder charges, which were dismissed again.
God, this dude's good.
After that, he mostly stuck to publishing until he retired in 1913. Huh. True to character, Teresa Urrea told the press that she had nothing to do with any of these raids or uprisings or invasions, but Porfirio Diaz and his government just weren't buying it. And records from both the Mexican consulate and complaints to the El Paso police from late 1896 and early 1897 show that the Porfiriato continued to blame Teresa for unrest along their northern border. They even sent an assassin after her in January.
I've been waiting for an assassin.
Following the assassination attempt, the U.S. Marshals stepped in and strongly encouraged Teresa and her father to move further north away from the border.
Strongly encouraged or forcibly told?
I get the sense told that we will not do anything for you if you don't leave.
That, yeah.
And after you've been shot at by assassins, that's pretty effective encouragement. They went to Clifton, Arizona. At least, officially, Teresa was in Clifton, Arizona.
That's still a border state. That's barely farther north.
Just further north to, like, not be able to walk to Mexico. Even in Clifton, there might have been another assassination plot. Technically, Teresa got married in 1900 to a Yaqui mine worker named Lupe Rodriguez. On their wedding day, Lupe held Teresa at gunpoint and tried to force her onto a train headed for the border. What? They legally separated 24 hours later.
On this, the day of my daughter's wedding.
What? You hold
on
her
the wedding
at gunpoint.
Day.
Yeah. Her husband held her at gunpoint on the wedding day and tried to force her onto a train bound for Mexico.
So are we thinking that he was paid off? Are we thinking that he wanted her to lead a more revolution?
The theory, so far as I can tell, is that he became an agent of the Porfiriato at some point and tried to deliver her. But it's incredibly unclear whether or not that was before or after convincing her to marry him.
If it was before, that is some dedication. Like, that
yeah.
is... It's terrifying.
Commitment to the bit. Like, yeah. And like,
it's terrifying,
horrible.
But that is some commitment.
As far as I could tell, they couldn't legally get divorced that fast. And Lupe left the country before they could actually get the marriage removed.
This is like the Princess Bride level. Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
You at least wait a day.
Like, they couldn't... under Arizona law at the time, have it annulled because he wasn't there, and they couldn't get divorced because he wasn't there. So legally, they stayed married after he tried to kidnap her at gunpoint.
Jesus. What the fuck?
Yeah, just what a couple of years for Teresa.
God. She's either not at all involved in this revolution and is just trying to help people, and then her husband randomly decides, hey, I'm going to kidnap you. Or she's absolutely involved in this revolution, and it's just another day.
Yeah, it could genuinely go either way based on everything she ever said and did.
That's so funny. It's also impressive if she was faking it the whole time.
Yeah, like an undercover revolutionary acting as a revolutionary pastor. Like,
yeah, that's impressive.
After the marriage gone awry, Teresa Urrea moved to California to continue treating one of her patients from Clifton. She went on a speaking tour and started a relationship with her translator before settling down in Los Angeles and having a daughter in 1902, a son in 1904, campaigning for union rights for Mexican immigrant workers, dying of tuberculosis in 1906, and becoming the main character of at least 5 novels, including 2 written by her own great-nephew.
Tuberculosis.
Yeah. If they died before the invention of penicillin, there's like a 50% chance that they died of tuberculosis.
Yep.
Yeah.
I hear John Green in the background yelling about tuberculosis.
I am thinking of the podcast Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, where die of tuberculosis is the free space on their bingo card. But this is not the end of the U.S. interactions with the Yaqui. It's just the end of Teresa's political career. Around the same time that the Ureas moved to Clifton, the Mexican army threatened the Yaqui people with full-scale war if their guerrilla rebels didn't stand down. Facing an army that was roughly the size of a quarter the entire Yaqui population, the Yaqui war chief Tatabiate and other community elders were forced to sign a peace treaty that required them to abandon their traditional communal life and adopt individual private property ownership.
What a dick.
Yeah, just Porfirio doing Porfirio stuff, furthering the genocide of several different nations. Well, wouldn't you know, after signing this deal, the Mexican army didn't withdraw. Instead, they military occupied the towns on the Rio Yaqui, harassed the local population, and started pressuring these people who had never owned private plots of land in their lives to sell their land to foreign businesses, especially American ranching and mining operations.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Well, in response, Tatabiate gathered his guerrilla fighters once again, and they were joined by an additional 2,000 Yaqui warriors to drive out the occupying army. Tatabiate led a portion of the Yaqui into a high plateau called the Mazacoba, apparently marching to attack and seize the port city of Guaymas. Some reports from the time claim that as many as 2,000 Yaqui marched north through, though the Mexican general commanding the army estimated that it was only 300, which would probably mean it was just Tatabiate's original group of guerrillas.
Yeah, also we're really going for the Spartan theme here.
Yeah, they have a strong Spartans of Mexico vibe to their whole thing, because now we've got 300 men making a dramatic last stand.
Yeah, like we're really leaning into the Spartan thing here. Spartans of Mexico is really cool, though.
I mean, there's a reason that, like, Teresa gets 5 novels about her. Like, there's some interesting stuff in here.
Awesome.
Though made up largely of inexperienced civilians and new recruits, the initial battle along the river featured one of the largest rebel forces ever assembled against the that had been assembled against the Porfiriato in decades. And the Mexican government responded in kind, fielding 5,000 soldiers to intercept and stop Tatabiate in a battle on the Mazacoba on January 18th, 1900. According to the New York Times, reporting a little less than a month after the battle actually happened, Santa Teresa was marching with them. And, like, probably not, but maybe.
That would be cool.
She certainly got around at the time.
She did that.
Maybe that's why that Yaqui guy was kidnapping her at gunpoint. Like, who knows? It's like, we need you as a mascot. Get on the train. It's almost certainly untrue. And the New York Times developed a nasty habit of blaming any and all violence in northern Mexico on Teresa Urrea. One article even blamed over 1,000 Mexican casualties on her personally, which,
damn,
seems a little crazy.
She's either a really good shot or they're lying.
Yeah, like, with, you know, 1890s break action rifles. She was a scapegoat for friends of the regime because she was a weird, heretical indigenous woman. In reality, the battle in this case was an utter disaster for the Yaqui people.
I was going to say that generally what happens when you have 300 people versus a couple thousand.
Yeah, 300 versus 5,000 is not good odds when you are defending a narrow pass in Greece. It is terrible odds when you are using guns on an open plateau. Roughly half of the Yaqui force was killed or captured in the fighting. Tatabiate escaped, but was killed by one of his own men who had become disillusioned by the defeat a year later. The following decade saw the Porfiriato enact a campaign that they officially labeled as a policy of extermination and deportation.
Oh my God, you just come out and say it.
Yeah, it was an official government-sanctioned genocide before the word genocide had been coined. Roughly half of the total Yaqui population was forcibly removed, and resistance was fatal. Evelyn Hu DeHart describes the Yaqui after 1909 as the most widely scattered native people of North America, spread even thinner and more brutally than the victims of the United States Trail of Tears.
God, that's putting forth effort, because Trail of Tears was awful.
Yeah, this is per capita and by geographic range, when all was said and done, one of the most brutal and total genocides in the history of the Americas. You know, it is not quite the complete annihilation of some Caribbean Islander peoples, but it is on par with the worst acts committed in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, yikes. And they were just open with it. Not even trying to hide it behind fancy words.
Yeah, they literally called it a policy of extermination.
Yikes.
The U.S., for its part in the crimes against humanity, passed laws to prohibit the Yaqui from emigrating to the North and instructed U.S. Marshals into Arizona to crack down on arms smuggling into Sonora.
Of course they did.
Evelyn Hu DeHart titled this chapter of her book, The Final Solution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How fucking ever, that is not the end of the story for the Yaqui people.
Hell yeah.
Thank God. Small guerrilla bands of displaced Yaqui continued to rebel against the Mexican government and receive arms from their relatives and allies in the United States. Then, in 1910, at 80 years old, Porfirio Diaz announced that he would not seek re-election, which created an air of hope, only to announce that actually he would run, and he would send his main opponent, Francis Madero, to prison. Decades of autocratic rule and the last-minute election fuckery galvanized the massive population of disgruntled landless peasants and wealthy liberals alike, and by the end of that year, rebel armies of all stripes were marching across northern Mexico. The Mexican Revolution is far too large a topic to deal with today, and it will come in more than one future episode. The resulting civil wars tore through Mexico and killed around 3 million people. But today, we are talking about the Yaqui. And during the Mexican Revolution, Yaqui freedom fighters allied with various revolutionary forces, playing an important role as arms smugglers thanks to their numerous family connections in Arizona. Eventually, American ranchers started getting nervous about the heavily armed revolutionaries crossing through their property, and on one hand, it is stolen land, so deal with it. On the other hand, it's pretty understandable to not want your neighbor's civil war to spill across the border into your literal backyard.
Yeah.
So they sent word to our friends at Fort Huacuca, again, and the soldiers stationed there were once again tasked with border control. Troop E of the U.S. 10th Cavalry. And these are the original Buffalo soldiers. I put that in the script.
Oh.
They drew the assignment for the first week of the new year in 1918. Under the command of their white captain, F.H.L. Ryder, who, and I love this, was called Blondie by his men. This actually seems to be a theme in the 10th Cavalry, because his counterpart in command of Troop H was nicknamed Pink Armstrong.
That's a great name.
Yeah. So, you know, the white captain of the black regiment, you got Captain Pink and Captain Blondie.
Love that.
Just great. So Blondie Ryder and his cavalry troop were patrolling Bear Valley, Arizona, when they encountered a group of 30 Yaqui revolutionaries walking their way back into Mexico. And the fact that they were entering Mexico is important. because it means they had just stocked up on guns and ammunition.
And it does.
The Americans were still on their way down the trail into the canyon when they spotted when the Yaqui spotted them and opened fire. The cavalry dismounted and tried to form a line, but were forced to take cover behind boulders. The Yaqui, for their part, just unloaded on the Americans, firing less for accuracy and more for sheer volume.
If you fire enough bullets, you'll eventually hit something.
Well, and the Americans kept pressing forward and the Yaqui kept backing up, but they also kept shooting. So the Americans changed tactic and concentrated all of their shots from about 30 of their own men on one small cluster of Yaqui, including, though they didn't realize this at the time, an 11-year-old boy, who was, in this case, a child soldier, so this is screwed up on all sides, but he was in the concentrated patch of fire on the battlefield at the time.
Not great.
After about 30 minutes, things calmed down. 20 of the Yaqui smugglers had managed to escape, while their fellows provided a very early example of rapid suppressing fire, which is not a tactic that had really been invented at this point.
I mean,
in terms of, like, military education.
If you have the ammo, you gotta use it.
You know, they had to dump some of it so that they would be lighter as they ran away.
Yeah, may as well shoot it.
Well, speaking of, at one point in the shootout, there was an explosion on the Yaqui side, which turned out to be one of the Yaqui smugglers getting shot in the bandolier, causing several rounds of ammunition to explode right up against his stomach, which in itself is
Ow.
Pretty wild. But that guy fucking lived. After the shooting stopped, the Americans provided first aid and took him back to the fort, where he and the other 8 survivors were kept as prisoners. But every American involved reported being very impressed. Ultimately, only one person was actually killed in the battle.
So they fired a lot of bullets, but they were not good shots.
The Yaqui had better cover, and weren't aiming to kill so much as aiming to get their friends' cover to go away. Once they recovered...
Blown up.
Blown... Bandolier explodes in the stomach and you survive to be taken prisoner.
I think I'd rather just die.
Well, this gets really interesting. Once they recovered, the 9 prisoners were put to work as laborers with the 10th Cavalry as they moved to a new station, which technically made them prison labor, aka the only legal form of slavery to this day. But the jobs they were doing were also a lot of the same jobs that the soldiers had to do. A few of the American soldiers knew Spanish, and the Yaqui eventually explained that they had only even opened fire because they saw a bunch of dark-skinned soldiers near the border and assumed it was the Mexican army who would have executed them for being rebels. If they had known it was the Americans, they would have just let themselves be arrested. All 9 of them, including the guy who had been gutted by his own bullets, volunteered to join the U.S. Army because conditions in the camp were way better than being guerrilla fighters in the mountains.
Yeah.
But the federal government denied it and put them on trial instead. They were charged with the heinous crime of failing to obtain an export license from the War Trade Board of the United States.
I love American bureaucracy.
And, you know, there were a ton of things that they technically could have been charged with, but they had a lot of good testimony from the soldiers who captured them, so they weren't charged with anything severe. The 11-year-old... naturally had his charges dismissed, and the other 8 had to spend 30 days in the county jail, after which they were allowed to legally emigrate to the United States.
Oh,
I would
America.
Hazard a guess that sometimes their working relationship with the cavalry had something to do with this.
Probably a lot of it. That's so funny.
30 days in jail. You open fire on the U.S. Army.
You do that now, it's bad.
Yeah, I mean, if you do that now in this context, you don't make it out. If you, like...
No. You, the next thing you know, you're being...
There's an Apache helicopter, like...
Yeah, like they're calling in Warthog, A-10 Warthog. Like, it's bad.
Yeah, the arms smuggling and shooting back at the army would not go quite as well today. Yaki fighters continue to be involved in various rebel groups, but the Battle of Bear Valley was one of the last military engagements where one side was specifically from the Yaki people. Even after the Mexican Revolution officially ended in 1920, some of the Yaki continued fighting, blurring the line between freedom fighter and bandit into 1927, when the newly formed Mexican Air Force bombed them with mustard gas.
Okay, we escalated a little bit.
Yeah. At that point, the last Yaki fighters began to surrender.
Wow.
Yeah. Over the following decade, attempts were made to force the Yaki to act as landowners and adopt modern agriculture, but they were ultimately granted formal recognition as an indigenous tribe and a degree of independent government with a system of credit societies that kind of let them rebuild some degree of communal farming if they chose to join. Many of them in the original Yaki River Basin are still poor farmers, who have to rent equipment and buy their seeds from big businesses and go into debt. But they do have official recognition from the Mexican government and are not particularly more targeted than any other group of poor indigenous agricultural workers. On the U.S. side of things, so many Yaqui resettled in southern Arizona that they were officially granted 200 acres of desert and became the only federally recognized Yaqui tribe in the U.S.
Huh. 200 acres of desert is not very much, but interesting.
It's right outside of the city limits of Tucson. So they're not cut off the way a lot of reservation land is. There is a chance another group will be recognized in Lubbock, Texas. But they haven't officially filed. They've only recently kind of organized.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Lubbock's not the place I would expect, but...
No. But that is the story of the U.S. interaction with the Yaqui. Do you have any final thoughts?
Just the U.S. government then and the U.S. government now are so eerily similar in some ways. And it's just... You can see the lines that follow of how we interact with foreign governments and how we deal with things internationally that just can have continued on since the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, if it wasn't blatantly ripping off Fallout, I would have incorporated the phrase "war never changes" into this podcast somehow, because one of the running themes is that America doesn't do it all that differently.
We do not. It's just the same. I mean, the way we handled some of it's different, but that's more of a contextual thing rather than a actually growing for the better.
No, because we were doing horrible things at the same time, and we do some random acts of weird kindness now. Like, it's just a continuous shit show, especially the more obscure it is, it's usually because we don't like to talk about it.
It's wild.
But
absolutely wild.
Yeah. This was an unexpected one for me, to say the least, but the program is about to kick us off. So do you want to tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Oh yeah. The podcast is Disastrous History. It's Disastrous History on all social medias. I'm very slow at uploading episodes, but I do have a backlog of 50, so they're not the worst thing that you've ever listened to. Allegedly.
All right. Well, go find Anthony and Disastrous History. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can hear me on the History of Persia podcast, and you can find me online at History of Persia or at History of Persia podcast, because I only run one social media account per platform. And if you want to financially support my projects, go to hopfulmedia.com.co to subscribe, buy merch, or do all of that fun stuff. Until next time, consider not invading Mexico, everybody.
Eh.
Hi. Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
If you're listening to this, you probably know that the United States of America gets involved in a lot of foreign wars. We all know the big ones, World War I, World War II, Korea, sort of, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq again. But before and in between all that, the story a lot of us heard in school is that the US military didn't get out much. Turns out, that's kind of a blatant lie. I'm gonna guess a lot of us don't know about the multiple Spanish-American wars, the wars that led up to the Battle of Little Bighorn, or the baffling number of times we invaded Mexico. Odds are you've never even heard of things like the time the Marines invaded Taiwan or the Oconee Wars. I'm Trevor Cully, host of the new podcast America Secret Wars, where I am going to sit down with a guest in each episode and dive into the history of all the forgotten and overlooked times that the United States deployed military force against other nations. You can find America Secret Wars at secretwarspod.com, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.